The Destruction of New York.
I really did think it was a series of stories that was all about attacking New York and highlighting its failures. But what I came to realize, there was also this other theme, which is a love for the city that was could only most powerfully be displayed and felt when you showed the city's disappearance.
That's Max Page. We'll talk to him about his book, The City's End.
And she was doing this illegally, and she first brought family and then extended family and then people from her village and then people from the surrounding villages and eventually people from the countryside all around northern Fujian province. And she became known as a snakehead.
And that's Patrick Radden Keefe talking about Sister Ping. She's one of the main figures in his book, The Snakehead. It's an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week marks the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. But before Al-Qaeda's jets crashed into the Twin Towers in the real world, millions of players of the software game Flight Simulator had crashed their fantasy jets into the same towers for years. Before that, King Kong threatened New York. The city's been destroyed by flood, a sudden ice age, aliens from other planets, nuclear war, and so on. All in the imagination of American writers, filmmakers, and artists. What is it about the city, as New Yorkers refer to it, that excites such fantasies of destruction? That's what my guest Max Page explores in his gorgeously illustrated book, The City's End, 2 centuries of fantasies, fears, and premonitions of New York's destruction. Max Page, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me.
Did 9/11 prompt you to write this book, or had you already started on it before that?
I had started on it before that. I had written my first book had a sort of a similar title called The Creative Destruction of Manhattan, which is about how the city was regularly, normally destroyed by the workings of the real estate market and slum clearance and city planning. When I finished that book, I spoke to someone at the New York Historical Society, and I said, I have so many wonderful fictional imaginings of New York's destruction. Maybe this would make a great exhibit. That was back in 1999 or 2000. And so we talked about that, and I actually finished the proposal for that exhibition, which was supposed to be a fun, you know, fun campy show, on September 10th, 2001.
That's really uncanny. And so, I mean, of course, your reactions were much more complicated than just thinking about the book on the day after that, on September 11th. But still, what were you thinking about your book as you watched and even videoed the towers come down?
Well, there's so many emotions and thoughts from that day, but what I had been thinking the night before about this fun show. You can imagine it. Everyone's sitting down at, you know, terminals and being able to play a video game or watching this series of destruction films. Suddenly I felt embarrassed, as if suddenly the next day what I was doing was somehow, well, some would say almost treasonous, imagining and almost making fun of this disaster. So I really just put it aside. It was just like, this is no longer a project to undertake. By 6, 8, 9 months later, I realized actually it was an important issue. It was important to understand not what caused 9/11, but what its meaning would be after that time.
Given what you've been writing about now all these years, the destruction of New York in the imagination, do you think that had anything to do with the choice of New York to be targeted by destruction by whoever brought down the towers, Al-Qaeda?
Well, famously, it was discovered among their belongings were flight simulator software, the Microsoft Flight Simulator, which I first used back in 1987, to fly through New York and, frankly, to fly into the trade centers. That was one of the things and I'm not the only one. I know that people all over the country, when you wanted to try out this new software back now 27 years ago, you flew to New York, and then you'd look to the towers. Could I fly between them? What would happen if you hit them? So in a way, New York's importance and its continued draw for people, including people imagining its end, I think certainly influenced the choice. Since they wanted to make an impact, a political, a violent statement, they chose our, and I would say the world's still most important city, and there, and those towers, which are its, are in some ways were its symbol.
You say actually that in your book, The Cities, and you say that every generation has its own reason for destroying New York. Why? First of all, why do we need disasters? And why do we need to imagine New York as the target of our disasters?
Right. Those are all the big questions I've been wrestling with. And I'll start with why New York? I mean, I think New York has been, since really the early 19th century, the cities, the nation's most important city. Even to this day, what's striking is, despite the rise of many other great cities within the United States, New York still remains kind of the center point for our economy, as we've seen in this past year, and for our culture. So that to attack New York, even fictionally, is in a way is a standard for the United States, is to attack this place. Why have we needed it? I think that to destroy the city, in New York City in particular, is to make a very strong political point about whether, and in each generation I say there was a different focus, whether it was to make a political statement or economic statement or cultural statement, but that is the most bracing way of saying this place, this civilization, has a fundamental flaw.
And yet you actually say that there are two themes, one dark, one light. The dark theme, you know, the city's destruction is our warning about some flaw in our civilization, as you just said. But you also say that the destruction of the city is a symbol of our homage and our love for the city. How does that work?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did not begin this project now a decade ago with that second, the lightness of this theme. I really did think it was a series of stories in film and software and poetry and music that was all about attacking New York and highlighting its failures. But what I came to realize, there was also this other theme, which is a love for the city that was could only most powerfully be displayed and felt when you showed the city's disappearance. In other words, we showed fictionally, this is what we could lose. And as I say, one of the glories, especially of watching a film, is, of course, the lights come up. And so that's part of the release we always have, even with a kind of a horror movie or the like, is that in the back of your mind you have this tension and then a release because the lights come up and things are back where they were. That's what it was, I think, about an homage to New York.
And so in a way, what we're doing is reestablishing how important the city is to us.
That's exactly right.
Now, as you say, the theme of the destruction of New York has been longstanding, has been one in every generation, and yet it has been one of different meanings. One has been, in a very early one, the very ambivalence towards cities. I mean, after all, there's an other myth based on reality of America as being founded in the yeoman values, the rural values, the small farmer, of who we have very few of them left now these days. And the first images of New York's destruction came about in the transition from a yeoman America to a more industrial America, where the city, New York City, became a symbol of corruption and vice. Could you talk about that view of the city?
Right. I think that is a fundamental tension, perhaps in Western civilization, but particularly in the history of the United States, which is that in some ways it is a nation founded on cities. If you think of the Boston Tea Party and Philadelphia Independence, I mean, it's Charleston, the heart of the slave trade. I mean, it's a nation, it's an early set of colonies based on cities, but in fact very powerful undercurrent that grows throughout the 19th century is a feeling that no, it must be a nation based in the country, on individual landholders who are independent players in this republic and not dependent people, whether slaves or workers who work in factories. So there's a very powerful tension, and in fact one of the first great outpouring of this dystopian literature of imagining New York's destruction, I think, comes in the late 19th century as New York and other cities, great industrial cities, rise and take their place as perhaps the most important centers of commerce in the country. And there's a rebellion, and part of that rebellion comes from the countryside, such as Ignatius Donnelly in his book called Caesar's Column, which was a bestseller, and it imagined how this city, because it was so unequal in wealth between the rich and the poor, between those who owned and those who worked for salaries or for pay, that this city and the civilization would collapse. It literally would just go up in flames, and there would be a column, this column created of the dead, piled high into the sky by this radical Italian immigrant. So there's a lot of racism that goes along with this movement as well. But at the heart of it was about this, the fear of what it would mean to have a nation of cities and a nation of people who rented and worked for pay in cities.
And talk about also the connection to vice. I mean, you talk about Tammany Hall. Tell us what Tammany Hall is and what role does that play in the imagination of those who imagine the destruction of New York?
Right. There's an undercurrent through much of the story that I tell about the fear of New York and its political corruption. Tammany Hall was the great democratic establishment, or anti-democratic, you might want to call it, that really dominated New York politics for many years in the 19th century. And there was a sense that it was, among the critics, was that it was dominated by immigrants, and it led its power by bribing these new immigrants. In other words, it was the masses were bound together, not by intelligent policies, but by bribes and the like. And so that the attack upon New York and imagining these destructive fantasies was a criticism of this runaway democracy.
So there's a conflation of prejudice, of anti-immigrant prejudice, with a concern for cleaning up, for purification of the city.
Absolutely. And there was, to many of the critics, saying that there could be no other solution other than the kind of a total cleansing. I don't think there's an accident that this whole period, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that there was a powerful sort of social Darwinist feeling, and it was quite widespread, and so that there was a sense that you needed to cleanse, literally cleanse, destroy through flame and fire the city.
And social Darwinism, the idea that the survival of the fittest, that those who are wealthy are in fact the fittest, and those who are poor are meant to die, are meant to fall away.
Correct.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Professor of Architecture Max Page about his book, The City's End. It's about how the destruction of New York has played out in the imagination, the literature, and in the culture of America. One interesting connection that you make in this early idea of the destruction of New York is the connection not only to or the critique of urbanism, but also of empire. There's a wonderful reproduction in The City's End of Thomas Cole, the artist Thomas Cole's painting, The Course of Empire. And of course, New York is called the Empire State. Why is it called the Empire State? And talk about this connection between empire and urbanism.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, New York clearly became the central economic force of the great American Empire. It had earlier been on the edge of empire, the Dutch Empire and the British Empire, and then became it grew as a great city because of the creation of the completion of the Erie Canal, which allowed New York to be the shipping point to and from the interior of the United States. That's what gave it its power, is that everything went from Buffalo over from the Great Lakes region, all the Midwest, over the Erie Canal, down the Hudson River, and then into New York's harbors and warehouses. So it became a symbol of the American Empire. I think that is one of the reasons why it continues to be the focus. If you're going to attack, make a criticism, a critique of the United States, you start with New York. And I think, frankly, I don't want to make a direct tie, but to Al-Qaeda, it's understood, or it's at least supposed, that the attack on the World Trade Center is a partly attack on the United States and its literally economic empire around the world.
And one of the earliest actual acts of destruction against New York that you speak about in the book is the 1920 bombing on Wall Street. I mean, here this powerful symbol again, the financial district. So we're not just, you know, they're not bombing Harlem. They're bombing Wall Street. And you link this with the beginning of mass society. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the fears or the developments that is fearful in some ways to many of those who are critical of the rise of cities even earlier is the rise of what we call mass society, that there are products, that the identical product will be purchased in the center of New York as can be purchased in Nebraska, that is through Sears Roebuck or Montgomery Ward, that radio starts to take off right in 1920s so that the same programs can be heard everywhere. And there's an ongoing fear, the long-standing fear, I think, in American society that rather than be individuals, people become part of a mass, whether it's salaried workers or whether it's people watching the same television programs or later on radio or and seeing and thinking the same thoughts.
But what's the connection with Wall Street precisely here? I mean, one could think of mass society as originating with Hollywood, not with Wall Street.
That's correct. I think that so many of the economic empires, whether it's in silver and gold or railroads or Wall Street, it all flowed into New York. And Wall Street became, in many ways, a symbol of that, the symbol of the tentacles of oligarchic capitalism, if you use the term of the day, being centered around the city. And the mansions that grew up along Fifth Avenue, which are featured in many of these books, including Caesar's Column, literally the wealth of the silver mines from Nevada flows in to those mansions. I mean, that's where the CEOs of the time lived. And so all the copper mines and the gold and then and Wall Street investors, it's all in New York. And Wall Street, of course, is a growing symbol of this concentration of power.
Well, you pointed before to this conflation of anti-immigrant prejudice with the fantasy of the destruction of New York. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that and bring us more into the 20th century. I mean, I think, for example, of King Kong.
Yes, I mean, King Kong has been much analyzed, but there is a sense of kind of the primitive, the beast, who is brought unwillingly into the city and the havoc he wreaks. Although there's also enormous sympathy for that particular beast, right, in that having only really wanting to go to his own mountaintop and ending up on the Empire State
Building.
It's
true. He's almost like Rousseau's A Noble Savage.
That's correct. Yeah, I think that's the idea behind that.
And you point also, perhaps not to the idea of immigrants, but the idea of the foreigner. Superman, the Superman comics during World War II, the idea, you know, kind of the anti-Japanese. So tell us, how was Superman, how did the Superman comics express this fantasy of New York's annihilation?
Well, the Superman comics and then the short films that I looked a lot at in the early 1940s played on really a long-standing theme, which is the fear of outsiders, the fear of the immigrants coming and, soiling the native stock, whatever that is, or just bringing their radical ideas, including the ideas of collectivism and the like.
Anarchism.
Anarchism and the like. So you have, I mean, it's each immigrant group gets its fair share, right? The Tammany Halls, the Irish, and then you have the Italians, the fearful Caesar, the radical in Caesar's column, and then you have the Japanese, of course, in anticipation of World War II, the Germans before that in World War I, so that each time there's this fear that we are going to be invaded. The flip side of that, or the another aspect of that, is that these racial fears are stoked in order to get America to build up its military and be prepared. That phrase, be prepared, starts way back in the late 19th century as the American economy has grown, but our military might, at least in the eyes of many, has not equaled that. And so that's the part of the push towards building up our military, World War I, before World War II, is to argue we're going to be invaded by these more powerful nations and their defective peoples.
We're talking with Max Page. He's professor of history and architecture at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Another theme you take up in The City's End is the fear of technology, that is, the impact of technology on cities like New York. For example, of course, the idea of New York being blown up by a nuclear bomb, a nuclear attack. I grew up in the 1950s. I consider myself a New Yorker. I was born in Brooklyn, and then I lived in northern New Jersey, just, 20 minutes from the George Washington Bridge. And I know that for me, of course, nuclear annihilation was something that was always in my mind as a child. Talk about that in this fantasy of destruction.
Well, it's interesting. I grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, and it was totally a part of my life as well. You hear the sound, the roar of jets overhead, maybe it was coming here. So yes, in the 1940s and then afterwards, the fear of nuclear annihilation dominates, obviously, the real policy discussions, but also the fictional imaginings about New York. What I argue is that New York became the way the society tried to understand the meaning of the atom bomb and the H-bomb and the impact that would have, literally playing out, this is what Hiroshima, USA, as one article titled it, this is what it might look like. This would be the impact on our society. So to literally try to grasp what that meaning would be, journalists as well as government planners played out fictions about what would happen to New York. And it had a lot of impact actually on the shape of cities afterwards.
How is that?
Well, what happened is that government officials, planners, and the like used the example of what would happen if a bomb were dropped on New York to argue for much more civil defense, argue for the highway system so that we could build suburbs and so there wouldn't be as much density. One of the biggest arguments was, look how vulnerable we are because all our economic might, all our people are in such small, dense places. We need to spread them out. And so that actually the creation of the interstate highway system and the expansion of the suburbs was in many ways a national defense policy. Partly is built on and partly is encouraged by these imaginings of, look what just one bomb dropped on New York City would do.
Now, the irony of that is that in latter-day fantasies of the destruction of New York, climate change plays a greater and greater role. And certainly we can argue a role no longer in the fantasy. I mean, this is something that you can go online and you can see under different scenarios, business-as-usual scenarios, just how much of New York is going to be destroyed and even all of it could be underwater, depending on what we do to combat climate change. And it's the suburbs themselves that, of course, are partly complicit in this, given the vehicle emissions that come from our unsustainable spread out into suburbia.
That's correct. I would make one note, which is I was struck writing from a period, obviously the early part of this century, where climate change is so central. It's fascinating to me how often the issue of some natural disaster, and specifically climate change, plays into the fantasies well into the past. I mean, I have this wonderful image of a glacier, a melting glacier right on Manhattan Island. This is an image from Amazing Stories, a very popular science fiction magazines in the 20s, right up through the 1950s and 60s. But there's many examples of imagining that there's some fundamental change in the natural environment, in the twilight zone. They play on this fantasy as well. But certainly one of the arguments is that our era is wrestling with climate change, and so that plays out in fantasies about New York. And so I think the hope among those who are making up these fantasies of New York destroyed by rising waters and the like are trying to make a political point, like Alexis Rockman, an artist who has done these wonderful murals, huge murals, imagining the city 300 years, 3,000 years in the future, and seeing that the waters have risen over and the city is utterly abandoned.
Yeah, describe them. They are beautiful. And you say that they're, you say in your book, The City's End, Max Page, you say that Alex Rockman's paintings are in fact highly researched. For example, you have one which I find has a really interesting title given what we were talking about in terms of empire. It's called Manifest Destiny, and it was painted in 2004. Maybe you could describe a little bit of what we're seeing in this reproduction in your book, The City's End.
Sure. This is a 2004 mural, huge, I think 9-foot-long mural that Alexis Rockman painted, and it actually is from the Brooklyn side, or it's actually looking over to Brooklyn, interestingly, And it's describing in 5004 what the scene would be. And he really researched what scientists, you know, in their best estimates, what would happen. And he shows that the waters have risen 85 feet near to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge towers. And then underneath the water, he shows all the kind of technologies, the nuclear subs, the oil cans and the like that obviously we have now and that are sort of the leftovers and the cause, frankly, of this disaster. So he really looks at what might have happened. One little interesting note is he includes a bridge that has never been built. This was proposed, the Santiago Calatrava Bridge. So we have in this mural not only buildings that exist that are destroyed, but buildings destroyed that haven't even yet been built.
You know, I want to introduce something in here, and that's a very personal experience. About 10 years before 9/11, I woke up and was lying in bed, and I had a very sudden vision of the Twin Towers falling. And it was so powerful to me that, you know, I told my friends and family about it over the years many, many times. And to me, the vision was of an earthquake, you know, that destroyed the towers. And so when it happened, you know, I thought, wow, you know, I must have in some way, you know, seen what was going to happen, had a sense of what was going to happen. But after reading your book, Max Page, after reading City's End, I thought, well, maybe not. Maybe this wasn't a psychic ability on my part, but that it was just part of this kind of cultural psychology that we are all part of, kind of that Jungian, what did Jung call it, the collective unconscious of those of us who are connected to that city.
Well, it may also simply be that without knowing it, you were seeing some of the cultural artifacts. I mean, there were comic books, there were films. From the moment the World Trade Center towers, not even when they were completed, already before they were completed, there were already imaginings of it falling down. In 1979, there was Meteor, which imagine a meteor bringing them down. There were comic books and the Fantastic Four. There's been many examples of this from the moment they were under construction. So whether or not you actually purchased those books or saw those movies, it was part of the culture. In fact, there's a famous line that I'm trying to remember who said it. It said, "There's the moment a building goes up, we already imagine its destruction."
And what is that about?
I think there is the skyscrapers are the great symbol of the 20th century, the great symbol of human technological and mastery, literally over gravity, and yet so that I think there's always a sense that, in fact, perhaps this experiment will fail. The worry, the fear that, in fact, what we are creating is not permanent. We know it's ultimately not permanent.
It's a modern-day Icarus story. The story of Icarus who flies too close to the sun. Here, I mean, it's a really very ancient meme, the idea of human technology, the human ingenuity being destroyed by its own hubris. I mean, you could talk about original sin and the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden.
That's correct. I accept that. I would argue that building those skyscrapers, I wouldn't call it inevitable at all. As a historian, I would never call anything inevitable, but there was a powerful investment in it. It was a powerful meaning attached to it. I would argue that the great artists and writers and inventors that came out of New York, partly what inspired them, what has made New York so great, is these great buildings and skyscrapers. That is part of the sense of this is a uniquely powerful spectacle. And this inspires people as well. So it is great hubris, but it is also inspiring.
Is there one image above all that strikes you, that moves you, that you came across and that you used in this book?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and it's one type of image. That is the image not of the city physically destroyed, where the buildings lie in ruin or they've exploded in nuclear holocaust, but rather a lone person running through the empty streets. So there are no people there, but the buildings are all intact. There's just one person, and that could be Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise. There's The World, the Flesh, and the Devil with Harry Belafonte. There's any number of fantasies that really cut to the core of me, because what it said was the city is nothing without the teeming masses of people rushing through the streets and the subways, and that the most awful thing is to see these glorious buildings empty and devoid of all all the people and all the life and culture and economic and life and strife that they bring. That is really what makes the city great.
Well, Max Page, your book is The City's End. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Max Page teaches architecture and history at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. In addition to The City's End, he's also the author of The Creative Destruction of Manhattan. And to explore more about The City's End and to see some of the images that the book reproduces, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, Patrick Radden Keefe and The Snakehead. Manhattan by Caetano Veloso. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The U.S. is a country of immigrants. Yet ever since the 9/11 attacks, life has become increasingly precarious for new immigrants, especially if they come here illegally, thrown into jail, summarily deported, sometimes denied due process of law. But such harsh policies didn't begin with 9/11. They began under the Clinton administration with the shipwreck on the shores of New York of the Golden Venture. The ship was carrying Chinese migrants from Fujian province. The wave of immigration from that region was facilitated by the so-called snakeheads of Chinatown. They smuggled people into New York in return for a hefty fee of thousands. Journalist Patrick Radden Keefe uncovers a story in his book, The Snakehead, an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream. I started out by asking Keefe what the police and Coast Guard found when they went to rescue the shipwrecked survivors of the Golden Venture.
Well, the ship came in a few hours before dawn. It was still dark, and it was a little stormy that night. The sea was quite rough, and there were two park police officers who were just doing a routine patrol along the beach and happened to see this ship that had run aground just offshore. And first they saw the ship and were kind of startled by that sight. And then what was more shocking to them is that they realized that people were actually jumping off of the ship and into the water and trying to swim to shore. And what happened is they radioed for backup, and hundreds of emergency personnel, police officers, people from the fire department, EMTs, came and sort of descended on the beach. It was actually one of the biggest rescue efforts in New York history. One of the people who was there on the beach that day compared it to a plane crash on the high seas. And what they were doing was basically fishing people out of the water as they tried to swim ashore.
So how many people made it? How many people actually didn't make it?
10 people died trying to swim to shore that day. Some of them drowned. What happened with some of them is that they had actually been in this ship for a long period of time on the voyage over, and they were malnourished. They'd been in the hold of the ship. They hadn't had enough food to eat. And so when they jumped into the water was quite cold, and they just didn't have enough body fat, really. So some of them actually went into cardiac arrest, and that was how they ended up dying.
Now, the first response was pretty compassionate toward the survivors, but it quickly turned more negative. What happened?
That's right. I mean, there are these amazing stories of the rescue workers basically seeing these people coming in. They realize pretty quickly that they're Asian and, in fact, Chinese, and sort of think, well, here are refugees. These are boat people. They've risked their lives in order to get here to the U.S. And so at first it's this rescue operation, and they were trying to save all these people who'd come off the ship. But then as the numbers began to sink in, both in New York City with the authorities there and also in Washington, which quickly got the news really as high up as the White House on that day when the ship came in June 6, 1993, people started making decisions and realizing that there are so many people that we wouldn't want to welcome them too much and send a message back to China to future people that they too should get into ships and make this journey around the world. So instead, we'll imprison them in order to send a message back that you know, we don't welcome just anyone, that you shouldn't leave China. And so what happened is that these passengers from the Golden Venture, who'd had this very long voyage in order to get to America, and then had many of them almost died trying to get onto the beach that day, were then thrown into prison.
And tell us why they were willing to take such risks. I mean, as you said, they were on the seas for months. It was the stars were not lucky for this voyage. They went through incredible hardship. Why were they willing to risk so much to do that?
Well, that's something I really wrestled with throughout the writing of the book. I mean, as you say, it was they'd been at sea for just a very long time, for what was eventually, it was about 120 days in the voyage. And just to give you a yardstick on that, the voyage of the Mayflower to Plymouth Rock in 1620 took 60 days, and the voyage of the Golden Venture took 120. Mm. And the people had paid smugglers, what in Chinatown was known as snakeheads, to bring them. And so they were all actually in debt to the snakeheads in order to make this terrible journey. And I tried to sort of figure out why it is that people would have wanted to leave. And I actually went back to Fujian Province, this area that so many people left during these years in this manner. And it's funny because Fujian was never the poorest part of China. In fact, it was doing fairly well during the 1980s and 1990s. There were a lot of economic reforms coming to the area, and some people were actually making more money than they had in the past. But the weird thing is that it's not actually absolute poverty that drives people to leave a country. It's how you're doing relative to your neighbor. So when the economic reforms came in Fujian province, some people started doing a lot better than others. And it was almost a keeping up with the Joneses thing, where somebody who had basically lived in the same conditions as his neighbor for years, his family had for generations, suddenly he looked over and the neighbor had a car or had a refrigerator or had a TV and was suddenly doing better and was building a bigger house. And at that point, the person in the first house sort of thought, well, you know, maybe I should go to the U.S. and try my hand there. I could make much more money and sort of better my lot in that manner.
It's kind of like what a lot of people think underlies revolutions, the revolutions of rising expectations.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. It's very geared to expectations. And I think particularly for Fujian, which is this area that so many people came from, it's right on the southeast coast of China, just across the strait from Taiwan. And it's always been one of the more outward-looking provinces in China. People have always left. You know, at first it was to go and sort of settle throughout the Pacific Rim in centuries past. And so in Fujian, I think there was a real keen awareness of how people were doing in other places in the world and a kind of seafaring tradition and a willingness to go out and take risks and try and, better your own lot and do that.
And of course, they weren't the first Chinese immigrants to come to our shores, but they really were a kind of second wave.
That's right. I mean, this is one thing that's really interesting when you look into the history of the Chinese in America, is that basically there have been two periods when you had a huge amount of immigration. The first was in the mid-19th century, when the U.S. was actively recruiting people from China to come and help build the railroads and work in the gold mines in California. And then, you know, eventually we had Chinese exclusion, and that lasted for about half a century, right up through the Second World War. And then shortly after the Second World War, you had Mao come into power in China, and he said nobody could leave. So you had almost a century where, either from our policies or China's policies, people really couldn't legally make the move. So what's funny is that first wave in the 19th century, they all came, or almost all of them came, from a tiny little area around what is today Guangzhou. And this second wave, which really started up in about the 1980s, the vast majority of people have come from the area in northern Fujian province. So it would be as if you went to China today, say, and all the Americans you met were from Providence, Rhode Island. It's a kind of a strange phenomenon as it plays out on the ground.
And as you say, Guangzhou, we used to call that Canton. Tell us now a little bit about the people who are behind this second wave of immigration. You title your book The Snakehead, and you're actually talking about one particular person, the central character of your book, and that's Sister Ping. Tell us who she was.
Sister Ping was a woman who grew up in Fujian province, and during her childhood experienced some really tumultuous events in China's history during the 20th century. She was a little girl during the Great Leap Forward, you know, the worst famine in human history, and the Cultural Revolution as well. And she ended up coming to the United States legally in 1981. She got a visa to come, and she moved to the eastern fringes of Chinatown in New York and opened a little shop. And almost immediately, she started sending for people. And she was doing this illegally, and she first brought family and then extended family and then people from her village and then people from the surrounding villages and eventually people from the countryside all around northern Fujian province. And she became known as a snakehead, a smuggler, someone who could move you from point A to point B, even if you didn't have a passport, didn't have a visa, didn't have permission to make the trip. And the way she did this was she had family members who worked with her, and she would bribe corrupt officials in various countries. And at first what she did was she sent people by plane, and she would get phony passports or phony visas and send them that way. And she charged quite a bit for this trip. In the 1980s, the fee that she charged was $18,000 a head. And by the 1990s, the price had gone up to $35,000. And already in the 80s, a lot of Fujianese were coming, and the Cantonese community in Fujian, in Chinatown actually looked down on them and referred to them kind of derisively as $18,000 men, because people knew that many of them had paid smugglers in order to make the trip.
And you say in the book, Snakehead, and I'm talking with Patrick Radden Keefe about that book, you say in Snakehead that she took advantage of the immigration policies then extant in the United States. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a number of different immigration policies that she took advantage of, but the chief one would be that shortly after the events of Tiananmen Square in 1989, George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, had an executive order which said basically that if you were coming from China and asking for asylum in the United States, that we would take a pretty favorable view to your application, either because you were coming and asking for asylum and saying, look, I'm a democracy protester, I was fleeing China because of my support for democracy, or because of China's one-child policy. Because many people at that time were fleeing the birth control cadres who would sort of come around and say, if you'd already had one or two children, look, that's it. And if you have more, we may force you to have an abortion. We may sterilize your husband. So what the first President Bush said was, if you can make it to the U.S. and you make a claim for asylum on this ground, we'll give you what they called enhanced consideration. Mm-hmm. And what this meant is that during the early 1990s, in the wake of this decision, there was suddenly a huge kind of boom tide of Fujianese getting on ships trying to get to the U.S. And in some instances, it was because they really were fleeing the birth control cadres and the population control cadres. In some instances, though, it was just that they knew if they could make it to the U.S. and make this claim, they had a pretty good chance of getting admitted. And Sister Peng and other snakeheads would coach their customers to come and kind of trot out these stories if that was what it took in order to get admitted to the U.S.
And that really caused a conundrum in a way. You know, talk a little bit about how that, what kinds of difficulties, ethical difficulties that really poses, in terms of, on the one hand, these are economic migrants, and that's seen as something that immigration authorities want to prevent. And on the other hand, the whole issue of refugees. So what kind of position did that put U.S. immigration officials into?
An incredibly awkward one, because, you know, the problem is, if you think about it, we want to admit refugees. This is a country where we admit, more refugees than any other in the world. If you have people coming and fleeing asylum and they can demonstrate that they're fleeing some kind of persecution, then our history and our tradition in this country are to say, look, we'll let you stay. The problem with the snakehead trade was that you really had a lot of people who were just economic migrants. And in those instances, we would probably want to deny people because that's sort of been the history. But they were all mixed in together, and everyone was asking for asylum. And unfortunately, I think the response, once all of these Fujianese started arriving, and particularly after the Golden Venture arrived, was to kind of paint them all with the same brush and say, look, we know that you're making these fraudulent asylum applications. Really, you're just economic migrants. The problem is that, say if you had 10 asylum seekers, it may very well be that 9 of them were frauds, but often the 10th was telling the truth.
Yeah, and this has gotten, of course, a lot tougher in this country, especially since 9/11. But you say in your book, Snakehead, that the Golden Venture was a kind of pivot in terms of immigration policy.
It absolutely was. The ship came in on June 6, 1993, and actually at that point, in about the 18-month period or two-year period prior to the ship arriving, almost 24 other ships had come from China and deposited people on U.S. shores. But this one arrived in this spectacular manner with this huge rescue operation. It was in New York City, the media capital of the country. Within hours, you had news helicopters out there, CNN, live broadcasts going out of all of these passengers struggling to shore. The Clinton administration had only been in office for about 6 months at that point, hadn't yet appointed a director of the INS. So there was nobody actually kind of running the show in terms of immigration in the country at that moment. And immigration was sort of a vulnerable point for the Clinton administration as is. There had been a number of other controversies in those early months. And in the country at large, there was kind of a shift in the mood against immigrants during that period of time. And so what happened is when the ship came in, a decision was made to send a message and to detain all of these passengers, no matter that they had come this great distance, they'd taken these risks, no matter that there may very well have been legitimate asylum seekers among them. The decision was made to arrest them or throw them in jail, not actually charge them with a crime apart from entering the country illegally, but throw them in jail. And there, many of them remained for the better part of the next 4 years. And the funny thing is, at the time, that was really unusual. At the time, if you came and you said, look, I'm not just an economic migrant, I'm here seeking asylum, we wouldn't lock you up while we tried to figure out whether or not you were telling the truth. And if you think about it intuitively, I mean, if somebody comes to you and they say, I'm fleeing the Sudan, and I was tortured there, on the off chance this person really was tortured, you're not going to want to throw them in jail and sort of punish them on top of what they've already escaped while you're trying to figure out whether or not what they're saying is true. And so that wasn't something we did. But when the Golden Venture came, we started. And the funny thing is, in the years since the Golden Venture, immigration detention of asylum seekers has gone from the exception to the norm. It's now the fastest growing form of incarceration in the country. And we actually have hundreds of thousands of people locked up in this way.
So what has happened, in fact, to most of the people? The majority of them stayed incarcerated, basically, for 4 years. Talk a little bit about what ultimately happened to them and also how they managed to get out.
Well, the passengers from the Golden Venture were farmed out to sort of a hodgepodge of facilities across the United States. But the bulk of them, over 100, were sent to a county prison in York, Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania. And some people have suggested that what the United States government was doing was basically trying to get these people away from any kind of support structure, where if they were in New York City, which is where they had initially arrived, there were a lot of immigration lawyers who were more than happy to come and do pro bono work to help them get asylum. But they were almost immediately bussed out to places like York. The funny thing is that when they arrived in New York, which is this Rust Belt town in central Pennsylvania, what had been a factory town, and still is, there's still a Harley-Davidson factory, a number of other factories in the area, but a number of factories had closed, and you had a population which was not especially hospitable to immigrants and hadn't actually had a lot of immigrants historically. But the community in New York suddenly found itself galvanized by the arrival of all of these Chinese detainees. And the churches started organizing, and people started going out and doing vigils every day in front of the prison. And eventually, a series of lawyers from York who'd never done immigration law before all volunteered to start helping out the detainees. And they ended up actually bringing their asylum cases, very few of which succeeded, and then suing the Clinton administration in a long court battle in order to try and get these guys out of prison. And the community kind of rallied around them. And what happened is that they didn't end up succeeding, unfortunately, in getting people out. And it was this very long and arduous and kind of unhappy process for the lawyers. But a real bond developed between the community in New York and the people in the prison. And in 1997, the New York Times ran a front page story saying, oh, you remember the Golden Venture back in 1993? All those guys are still in jail. They were never charged with any crime, but they're all still locked up in jail. And after the piece ran in the Times, Bill Clinton pardoned the Golden Venture passengers, and he paroled them out of jail. And when I say he paroled them, he didn't put them on a path to citizenship, didn't give them green cards. So what happened is they were no longer in jail, but they weren't technically allowed to be here. It's sort of a nebulous state in terms of their immigration status. And the irony there is that that is where many of those passengers remain. Today, they live in the United States. They're still parolees. They have to check in with immigration once a month. And now they own property, they own businesses, they pay taxes, they have children who were born here. Some of those kids are going to college. But the parents who came here all those years ago in 1993 still live in kind of a gray area and could be deported any day.
I'm speaking with Patrick Radden Keefe about his book, The Snakehead, an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream. Talking about this underworld now, Sister Ping was part of it. She actually wasn't the main person who organized the Golden Venture. Tell us who did and his position in that underworld.
His name was Ake. He was a young guy, very young at the time, still in his 20s, and a gang leader. He was a Fujianese youth who had come over. He'd been brought over by a snakehead himself while he was still a teenager and joined a gang called the Fuqing Gang, which is a very violent youth gang in Chinatown in New York City. And Ake was a pretty brutal individual. He ended up, years later, pleading guilty to 5 murders. And he was engaged in extortions, beatings, kidnappings, all forms of racketeering and criminal activity. And he moved into the snakehead business. And he had a specialty, which is that when the ships came in with passengers on board, he and his gang would go out and offload the ships. They would take fishing boats out to meet the ships in international waters and then bring the passengers back in and hold them hostage until they'd paid their fees. And a very fateful decision that Sister Ping made in the early 90s was to go into business with Ake. And they had a kind of tense, slightly rivalrous, but also kind of codependent relationship. And the two of them ended up cooperating on the Golden Venture.
And in fact, now, Sister Ping is in prison, not just for her role in the Golden Venture, but that certainly led to her being fairly high profile, because what you say is there was a crime epidemic happening at that time with the Chinatown gangs, but that it wasn't really very high on the radar screen of anybody outside of Chinatown itself, not even the police. But this made her more high profile, the Golden Venture. She's still in prison, but Ake is out.
Exactly. This is one of the troubling twists in this story, is that Ake, the violent gangster that Sister Ping had collaborated with, he ended up getting arrested shortly after the Golden Venture in August of 1993. And it would take years to get Sister Ping, but when Ake was arrested in 93, almost the first thing he said to law enforcement was, "I can help you get Sister Ping." And so he started cooperating. And Sister Ping was a pretty wily character, so it actually took another 6 or 7 years before she was arrested. She was arrested in 2000. But she was eventually extradited to New York City and tried in 2005. And Ake was the lead witness against her. He had gone over and started cooperating with the FBI and became a really prolific FBI informant and ended up pointing the finger at Sister Ping in open court. And after she was convicted, the judge, who just ironically enough was Michael Mukasey, who went on to become the Attorney General of the United States, this was his last major case, he sentenced Sister Ping to 35 years in prison. She was about 60 at the time, so this is really the rest of her life in prison. And after she was sentenced, Ake was quietly let go because he had cooperated and helped them put her away. And so in exchange, he was set free.
And, you know, it's ironic in a way because she actually is seen in Chinatown, you say, in your book, Snakehead, that she's seen as an honored member of the community, that people really don't see her as a criminal and couldn't understand why she was put into prison. That's certainly her position as well. So after reporting all this, and this is really an incredibly in-depth investigation into this phenomenon of Chinese immigration and the snakeheads in the latter part of, you know, of the 20th century, after doing all this reporting, do you feel that she's a hero or a villain?
Well, I wouldn't say she's a hero. I think she's complicated in that she did help many, many thousands of people achieve better lives in the United States. And that's part of the reason that there's this huge reservoir of sympathy for her in Chinatown, and that people regard her as this Robin Hood figure. But at the same time, she charged a lot of money for the services she provided, and there were instances in which she put people in ships that overturned and people died. She was a little callous that way and cold-hearted, and I think very devoted to the economies of scale. She was a businesswoman. She wasn't doing this for altruistic reasons. You know, when I told the people at the FBI who went after her that she'd that in Chinatown they referred to her as Robin Hood, they came back and said, "Well, Robin Hood never made $40 million, which is what they estimate that she made." Mm-hmm. So I see her as a morally complicated person in that she was incidentally able to do a lot of good and help a lot of people create better lives. But in terms of her motivations, I don't think of her as a hero or an altruist. And to the extent that there is that view pretty widely held in Chinatown and also in China, I think that that's a little bit nostalgic, a little bit misguided. I think it misses the point of what was really making this woman tick.
Now, China is a very different place now than it was then. What's happened to this kind of immigration? What's happened to the snakehead as an occupation?
Things have changed, you're quite right. When I was in Fujian province about 18 months ago, China was still booming, and there was huge amounts of manufacturing going on. And what people told me when I was there was really that there are still snakeheads operating. The fee has gone way up to $75,000 for passage. But there are far fewer people leaving now than used to. And part of that is just market saturation, that you know anybody who wanted to go ended up going. But part of it was also that there were more opportunities in China than there had been ever before. And that people would say to me kind of contemptuously, why would I want to go to some American city and work as a dishwasher in a Chinese restaurant when I could stay here and get a great job in China's new economy? So the business, to some extent, had dried up. I should say, though, that in the last 8 or 10 months, since the advent of the economic crisis, manufacturing in China has been really hit. And a lot of the coastal boom towns in southeast China, in places like Fujian province, but also around Guangzhou, some of these big manufacturing centers, are beginning to basically turn people away. There aren't as many jobs as there were. And we're already seeing a huge internal migration in China of people leaving those factory towns on the coast and going back to their ancestral villages inland that they left in the past so that they could find better jobs. I think that if the crisis continues and we don't see an improvement in the manufacturing base in China, that we could very well see some of those people start turning to snakeheads. You know, rather than go back to your family's village inland somewhere in the interior, I could see people turning to snakeheads and saying, no, instead, why don't you take me abroad?
But once they get here, they're spending an awful long time paying off their debt. It's almost a kind of slavery.
It is. I mean, the trick, though, is they are working like slaves, but the funny thing is that people know what they're getting into. I mean, this was another thing I sort of struggled with through the writing of the book, is that you often hear this kind of activity referred to as human trafficking or virtual slavery, but most of the Fujianese, the undocumented Fujianese I interviewed who had paid snakeheads to bring them over, told me that they knew when they were coming that they were going to have to pay off the debt. They knew that they were going to be working in exploitative jobs that paid them under the table and below minimum wage. They knew all that going in, but for them, the real issue was, if I can get there, if I can do it, if I can pay off the debt, if I can have a family in America, and someday my kids can be U.S. citizens and go to American colleges, then it's all worth it. It all makes sense. You know, so there's a sense of kind of generational sacrifice where they're saying, I may suffer, but so long as I know that the next generation will do better than I have, it all makes sense.
Yeah, in fact, at one point in the book, you say that that Snakehead is a story of a mile. And it comes from a quote by Gary Locke, governor of Washington, who himself is of Chinese descent.
That's right. And he gave an amazing and moving speech, which is in the book, but I would also encourage your listeners to look it up online, where he talked about how his grandfather had come to Washington almost a century earlier and had worked as a houseboy, and how today, just barely a mile from there, Gary Locke was governor of the state, you know, in the governor's mansion. And he said that this was a mile. It took a century for my family to come that mile. And I did think of the snakehead in a way as the story of that mile, the story of the road that people take, not just Chinese, but any immigrant group, from the moment they enter this country and their efforts to get a toehold to the point where they gain some legitimacy and join the American mainstream.
Well, Patrick Radden Keefe, thanks so much for talking with us here at Writer's Voice. Your book is Snakehead, an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. You can listen to all our shows, plus find out much more about our guests and their books at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.